For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Rabbi Mordechai Pollack.
I don't know who this Pollack guy is. My name is Rex. And I have a story to share with you. You ready? So I was driving my Harley on the West Coast Highway. And minding my own business, I was having a great time. Wind was blowing in my hair. I mean, it was really a nice time. And I heard a voice. And the voice said, Rex. And I said, yes. And he said, you've been a good boy, so I'm here to grant you one wish. And I knew right away what I wanted. I said, I want to be able to drive my Harley to Hawaii. I've always wanted to be in Hawaii. I'll take my bike, I'll go to Hawaii. So I want a bridge that'll take me from here to Hawaii. So the voice said, you know, that's pretty self-centered. I mean, can't you think of something a little more altruistic? I mean, I could do it, but, you know, it's really not the kind of wish I was hoping you would ask for. So I thought, and I thought, and I thought, and I said, I know exactly what I want. I want to be able to understand my wife. Not only do I want to understand my wife, I want all men to be able to understand their wives. To understand what they mean when they say everything's okay when I know it's not. And when I'm getting the silent treatment to really understand what's going on, I want all men in the world to understand their wives. And there was silence. And then the voice said, would you like that bridge to be one lane or two? So good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My point in coming is not to make fun of clueless men or complicated women. Many have done that very successfully before me. But my point in starting out with that little anecdote is to point out that a lot of confusion, I think, surrounds the whole topic of men and women getting along. And part of that has to do with the fact that I think our focus sometimes is in the wrong direction. Very often we're focusing on understanding our spouse or understanding our partner, and that really often is not even possible. Our focus really needs to be figuring out, understanding our spouse, understanding our partner for us, but more importantly, really understanding what our job is. What is it, what is my job in the relationship? So I very much appreciate you all coming this morning, getting up early and coming on a Sunday morning to learn a little bit with us. I want to start off, of course, thanking HOD and Alan for making this happen. Appreciate that very much.
Thank you.
And Young Israel, Rabbi Starr, for hosting this little event here. Appreciate that very, very much. I'm very happy to say that Alan came in January to a B'nai Torah presentation that I gave, and this is now in the spring. This is the first of several presentations I'm going to be giving, God willing, in many different places around town. So it really is very exciting that people are interested in learning about these. My wig is coming off here. Learning about this topic. And, as Rabbi Starr started off by saying, it's something that I think we have the illusion of thinking when we're younger, before we're in a serious relationship, it's easy. What's the problem? You talk nicely and everything goes well. Well, if you're married for even a short time, you realize it's not so simple. So that really is the our focus is going to be this morning, talking a little bit about that. I realize there are some folks are married, some folks are not married. Certainly the ideas and the skills that we talk about here are appropriate for all relationships. Gary Chapman, who's the author of the book that we're going to be focusing on, The Five Love Languages, has written a slew of books having to do with some with singles, some with teens, some with kids, all around the concept of the five love languages. Just real quick before we get into this, how many have read or are familiar with the Five Love Language Model? Okay, just a show of hands there. Thank you. So it is, and I asked that question 4 or 5 years ago when I was introduced to it and started talking about it a little bit, and very, very few Jews had actually heard of it. It's a Christian-based book, which we have gotten permission to alter, censor, if you will, for the Jewish community. Got permission from him and his publisher. So I don't think that's why it's become more necessarily more popular in the Jewish world, but I've seen articles written in Jewish periodicals. It's certainly something that is seeping into the Jewish world, which I think is a beautiful and important thing. So the schedule this morning, I'll give a little bit of an overview, 30-minute, 40-minute overview of the model, mixing Jewish sources, some psychology, self-help stuff, some book, etc., and some stories, and then I'll stop for questions. And the questions, I just want the guys to feel relaxed and comfortable. The questions will have nothing to do with no personal disclosures, please. This isn't, this is no personal, this isn't group therapy. So that, you're welcome to ask questions, and please think about those questions as we're going forward. But, we'll keep those generic about the topic, about the subject, as opposed to about ourselves. And then we will, close up, thanks to a gift from Melanie and Danny Frank, our books for everyone to take home with you, and very excited that we're able to do that, and you can take it home, read it, and discuss it. Very important work. So, Chapman, in the beginning of the book, asks the question which I suspect many of you are asking, and that is, why another book? If you go to Amazon, you go to a bookstore, you see a gazillion books on relationships. Why do we need another one? So he answers the question by saying that so many of the books out there on relationships are starting at the wrong place. They're simply starting at the wrong place. So I would suggest there's really the three C's of relationships. There's a climate in the relationship, there's communication in a relationship, and then there's change in the relationship. And change, of course, means I want to change, not you have to change. But climate is the first of the three C's. So a lot of books, if you look at the stuff that's out there, a lot talk about communication and active listening and all that stuff, very kind of complicated stuff. There's a famous book by Hendrix called Getting the Love That You Want, Imago Therapy. I find it fascinating, but a lot of it is kind of complicated, and again, a lot of it starts at the second step. His book, on the other hand, is very, very simple, very straightforward, and really does start at the beginning with improving the climate in the relationships. And I think also because relationships are so complicated, the stuff that we learn about them has to be even more simple than other areas of our life. We really need simplicity in general. In interpersonal relationships, we get this cue from Ethics of Our Fathers, from Pirkei Avot, which is, like, in contrast to other areas of Torah, which are quite complex very often. Ethics of Our Fathers are short, memorizable quotes that the rabbis have put down for us to learn how to interact properly with other people. Because personal interactions are complicated enough. The ideas that we need really need to be simple and easy to remember. And that, I think, really is what this book, this model, does. The word in Hebrew for love is? Ahava. Very good. Ahava. Ahava means to love. Ahava really is based on the word hav, which means to give. The basic Jewish idea is that when we want to get close to someone, we give to that person. Of course, the feelings of love encourage us and engender giving, but really it starts with the action. The action encourages the emotion. And that's an important idea. And that's really the idea of the five love languages. The whole premise is that when I give to someone that I love about, I get closer to that person. And that relationship is stronger than it was before. The greatest act of giving really is to extend myself. If I'm not just giving, but I'm giving it in a way that's not so comfortable, that's a little bit hard for myself, that's the greatest act of giving. Because that means the only reason I'm giving in that way is because I care about you. So, again, as we'll see in the five love languages, the greatest act of love is extending myself, and this model, I think, helps guide us how to do that. We all know innately, and we know from psychologists, from research, the greatest human need, one of the greatest human needs, is to feel loved and appreciated by other people. And that's something we can't do for ourselves necessarily. You know, I always compare it to tickling. You can't tickle yourself. So that someone else, someone who's important to me, who shows love, who gives to me because they love me, that's satisfying the deepest, most important need that each and every one of us has. The problem, however, that he addresses, I think, beautifully, is that we often miss the mark. We often don't know exactly how to give. We don't know how to connect. You very often see couples who are struggling in their relationship. They both care a lot about each other. They both want to give to each other and show their affection and their love and concern to each other, but they don't know how. Especially the guys. Just don't know how. so that if we have a tool, if we have a model to follow that's simple, that we can remember, that we can say, well, wait a second, how can I show my affection and love to this person effectively? And we do that, the relationship is enriched, the relationship is brought to a whole different level. Okay, so now the five love languages themselves. Gary Chapman argues that there are five ways that every single human being feels loved and appreciated. And those five are, let me list them before we get a little bit more into the model. Those five are words of affirmation, saying things to each other, compliments, etc. Number two is quality time, spending time with each other. Gifts, giving and receiving gifts. Acts of service. And last but not least, physical touch. So again, words of affirmation, quality time, gifts, acts of service, and physical touch. So there's five love languages. There's five languages that we all speak, that we all feel when we speak and we hear, we receive. We feel loved and appreciated in all five ways. At the same time, there is a language or two that resonates with each of us more than the others. So that if we can identify which language is my language, or maybe even more importantly, which is my spouse's language, my child, my friend, whoever it is, if I can figure out, if I can zero in on that particular language, and then I can start speaking that language, that deposit, so to speak, in their love tank, as he puts it, is much bigger than if I speak the quote-unquote wrong language, the language that's lower down on their priority list. If I can figure out this person's love language as gifts, and I start giving that person gifts, so that deposit, the impact that that's going to have on them is much greater than, let's say, spending time with them. Because that's what fits them. And narrowing it down to five, and talk about different dialects within the five, but narrowing it down to five, I would argue, is something that we can do. It's something we can remember this list, figure out based on questions and based on the quiz he has at the end of the book, what our love language is, what our spouse's love language is, and learn to speak that love language. So it gives us an ability to be focused on one or two things, and not to be just in general, I want to make this relationship better and I don't know where to go. It's a bit of a roadmap in helping us build the relationship. Now, of course, the irony is, not an irony, this is the way God planned it, husbands and wives rarely speak the same language. That shouldn't surprise anybody. That's the point. The point is that if I am a quality time person and my wife is a gifts person, then I need to grow towards her in order to speak her language, which is not so comfortable for me necessarily. They're both quality time people, and you spend time together, that's great, that's fine, that happens, I'm sure. But if I'm giving to you specifically because that's what you need, it's not what I feel comfortable giving, but it's what you need to hear, that again shows tremendous love and tremendous appreciation, because I'm willing to grow, I'm willing to be a little uncomfortable only because of you. It's not because of me, it's because of you. So it's not just the act, but it's the moving, it's pushing the envelope of myself, it's growing myself as a person. And as he points out, just before we get into each of the five love languages, as he points out, that someone visiting a foreign country may learn some lingo, learn how to ask where the bathroom is, and you learn the basic catchphrases that you need to be. If you're visiting France, you learn a little French, you don't necessarily need to be fluent. You don't necessarily need to be as fluent as the guys there. That's true also, I argue, in the five love languages. One need not feel daunted by the fact that I'm just not a good gift giver, which I'm really not. And that stops everything. No, you identify the love language of the person you're trying to get close to, and you work at that. And even if your French isn't perfect, that's fine too. But the point is that you're growing in that direction. Okay, so I want to start off with going through again each of the five love languages and share a little bit about each one, and then we'll stop and take your questions. So, there's a famous story, one of my favorite stories in the Talmud. The story is told about Akiva. Akiva, who later becomes the famous Rebbe Akiva, was a 40-year-old ignoramus, to a certain extent a self-hating Jew. He didn't like Jews, he didn't like Judaism, he was really disconnected from his tradition. And the Talmud tells us that he was walking along and he saw water dropping on a rock. And that water was making an indentation in that rock. And Rabbi Akiva noticed this. And he said, if that water, which is so soft, can make an indentation in that rock, which is so hard, the Torah, which is compared in many places in Jewish sources to water, can make an impression on me. Despite the fact that I'm so hardened and so distant and so cynical, it can make an impression on me. And he went out and he became the great Rabbi Akiva, the leader of our people. So from that story alone, it would seem that he was a self-made man. He saw the rock, he took a lesson from it, changed his life around. Well, in 1954, there was a book written called Motivation and Personality by a professor, I'm sure you've all heard of, Abraham Maslow, Jewish professor, Brandeis University. And that's when he suggests what is today his famous hierarchy of needs, in which he says, and this has become incorporated one of the basic ideas of learning in Psychology 101, that there are certain needs that's being portrayed. He apparently never portrayed it as a triangle, but if you Google it, that's basically all you'll see is a triangle. And at the base of the triangle is physiological needs. In order to get anywhere in life, you need to have your basic needs, food, clothing, shelter, met. You can't worry about anything else, you have nothing to eat. The second stage that he talks about is feeling safe. Feeling safe, knowing you're okay, you're safe. The next, the middle rung, is love, feeling loved and appreciated. And it's the higher two, self-actualization, self-esteem, those types of things are building and creating and going beyond, taking what you've got, changing the world, changing for your family, building buildings, building organizations, building a family, etc. So again, he argues, unless you've got the step before taken care of, you really can't move up the ladder, you really can't move up higher up on the triangle. When Rabbi Akiva comes back with tens of thousands of students, he turns to them with his wife present and says, Shali v'shalachem shalach. Really, everything that I've accomplished and everything that you've accomplished is really to her credit. Because when his wife, the famous Rachel, met him, he was an ignoramus. He was a nobody with very little obvious potential. And yet she said, no, I see something in this guy. I see tremendous potential. And one can imagine the conversations between the two of them. She built him up. And she said, you can do it. There's something inside of you that has to be brought up. You can be great. So it wasn't just the water and the rock. It was really his wife. It was really Rachel who made him great. And later, years later, decades later, when he was famous and successful and powerful and the one that everyone looked to, the leader of the Jewish people, he credited her because of the words of affirmation that she had given him over those years that's allowed him to be great. To the extent that Rabbi Akiva says, Ve'ahavta re'ach kamocha, the verse that Rabbi Star just mentioned, we just read yesterday, that you should love your fellow like yourself, Rabbi Akiva is the one who famously says, Zeh klal gadol b'Torah, this is the basic, the foundational idea in the entire Torah. All of Judaism really rests on that idea. Because he was a product of that. He realized he was a nobody, and he would have stayed a nobody if it wasn't for his wife showing that love and showing those words of affirmation that created him and allowed him to do so much for the Jewish people. So he was a direct recipient of that love and of her words of affirmation. Just to end this piece about words of affirmation with a little story and maybe a little practical idea, and that is Sam got himself a new dog. So he invites a friend over and says, I want to show you some, introduce you to my dog, show you some of his tricks. Sam picks up a stick. He throws the stick and says, fetch! The dog rolls over and says, life is so hard. I just had to move into this new house. He doesn't take care of me well, doesn't feed me enough. I left my friends behind. Life just stinks. So the friend turns to Sam and says, what was that? So Sam says, he thought I said kvetch. So we have to ask ourselves, ladies and gentlemen, no belated reaction there. So we have to ask ourselves, do we kvetch sometimes too much? And if we're kvetching a lot, then we're not speaking words of affirmation. It's not only to our spouse, to our family members, but just in general, if we're looking at life through negative, through the gray lens, through, it's raining, it's snowing, it's whatever it is, there's too much pollen, it's too nice out, whatever we're stressing about, that means we're not spending those words and that time and that focus on words of affirmation, being positive about ourselves and about others. So that's something to think about. Again, I hope to get a little practical at the end of each of these. This point, the practical one of the words of affirmation would be not to stretch so much, leave that to the dog. Don't fetch so much positive, talk positively to others, etc. It really goes a long way. The next one is quality time. This, I think, is absolutely fascinating. If you look in our Torah towards the end in Deuteronomy, you see there's a mitzvah that when a young man meets a young woman, they get married. There is a mitzvah, Shana Rishona. Shana Rishona means the first year a husband and wife have to spend time together. It really is a mitzvah on the husband, since the husband, certainly throughout history, is the one who is more involved in travel and being away from the home. So the mitzvah is he's not allowed to leave home. He has to stay home. So if you look at the Sefer HaChinuch, the famous book that explains each of the 613 commandments, it's fascinating what he writes. He says, why does he, the husband, the new husband, have to stay home? Because he has to try to figure out his wife. Now again, I don't mean really figure out, because it'll take a lot longer than a year. But he has to understand what, you know, the basics of what she likes, what how she wants her house run, what the expectations of him are. That's the mitzvah of Shana Rishona. I will point out there's no such mitzvah for the women. It's a mitzvah to men, stay home so he can learn her likes and her desires and her wishes. To accept, as John Gottman, the famous Jewish researcher in Seattle, writes in one of his many books, that he can determine a successful marriage based on whether the husband is willing to take influence from his wife. Not the other way around. It's whether we're willing to spend that time, the mitzvah to spend that quality time with one's spouse to accept the influence, to learn each other, and specifically the husband to pick up from his wife. So spending that time is crucial for a long list of reasons. I think that's a fascinating one, since we have a mitzvah in our Torah 3,300 odd years ago, and research today is showing that that's very much, very much the case. There's a cute little story I'd like to share with you. This is one of Mitch Albom's, not as famous as Tuesday's Mori, but a very very interesting book. It's written about his rabbi from Philadelphia, Rabbi Albert Lewis. So in 1958, Rabbi Lewis apparently said this story in one of his sermons. A little girl came home from school with a drawing she'd made in class. She danced into the kitchen where her mother was preparing dinner. Mom, guess what? She squealed, waving the drawing. Her mother never looked up. What? She said, tending to the pot. Guess what? The child repeated, waving the drawing. What? The mother said, tending to the plate. Mom, you're not listening. Yes, I am. Mom, the child said, you're not listening with your eyes. So, the Mount of Babes, we learned a very important lesson, I think, and that is, we often are attentive, but yet not very attentive. We're very busy with our email. We're busy now in the last, whatever, month with our smartphones. We've got 1,001 excuses not to be attentive. And I don't think ever in history we've been so not attentive. And therefore, when we talk about quality time, we have to think about that. We have to think about, do we have time specifically set aside for the people that we love? Specifically set aside for our spouse, so that it's kid-free and technology-free for a certain amount of time, a week, or whatever we, you know, whatever time we decide to do that, but to really put things away. There's nothing, by putting the cell phone away, you're saying there's nothing more important than you. What you do, we all realize, is secondary. It's really not the most important thing. The most important part of quality time is you're there, you're present, your focus is on the other, you're not focusing on yourself, you're not focusing on business, you're not answering texts. That's it. It's just spending that quality time with two people together. Okay. Receiving gifts. Receiving gifts, again, this one is close to my heart since I'm not a very good gift giver, and this is one of my wife's love languages. There's been a lot of research done, ladies and gentlemen, it shouldn't surprise anyone, that when there's a lot of brain research these days with MRI, I mean, just amazing the technology that's being done today with psychology and really figuring out what makes people tick. So there's been a tremendous amount of research done showing that gift giving raises one's pleasure hormone even more than receiving. There is a book called Why Goodness is Good for You, but written by a fellow named Hamilton, and he did a study where a group of people were divided into two groups. One group was given money and said, spend it on yourself, get whatever you want. The other group was said, take the money and give to someone else. And then they checked in with them afterwards and did certain tests, and they found that those of Akhtar themselves certainly had a high from whatever they purchased, but it waned very quickly. It disappeared almost immediately after they got it. They played with it for a little while, and that was it. Those who gave, on the other hand, they could test and see that their feelings of satisfaction, the pleasure, lasted much longer than the other group. And this is illustrated in different verses and different Jewish sources. Gift giving, and to others, chesed, as we call it, is a basic Jewish value, and it's good for you. It's good for you, makes you feel good, it certainly makes the other person feel good, it connects you for a list of reasons. The holiday of Purim, I think, is very instructive. Purim is a very enjoyable holiday. So if you look at the story, you see that Haman, the wicked Haman, the Hitler, if you will, of his time, got up and said, you know, the Jews are not together. There's no unity. They're all fighting. This is a great opportunity for me to go in and get them. Because he understood that if they didn't get along, if there's infighting among the Jews, and unfortunately we've seen this theme repeat itself time and time again, when the Jews aren't united, we can do almost anything to them. And we know the story, tries to commit genocide against the Jewish people, there's a tremendous miracle, and we are saved. So the mitzvot, the commandments that come out of Purim, there's four of them, two of them, giving gifts to the poor and sending gifts to other people, have to do with gift giving. So that the antidote to Haman's awareness that the Jews were not together, there's a tremendous amount of discord, the antidote that the rabbis saw fit to put in place forever, for thousands of years, is to give gifts. And that builds bridges, that builds relationships, that builds community. So specifically gift giving that we can use to build a relationship with our spouse, with our friends, with everyone, with other people in our lives. It is very often true that, research has shown this time and time again, that in any relationship, you almost always invariably have a saver and a spender. You have a saver and a spender. That's just basic, right? I won't ask for show of hands. But we all know that in a relationship, that's going to be true.
He's probably spending now.
I won't touch that one. So this is a basic dynamic in any relationship. So that the saver has to appreciate that if their spouse's language is gift, they need to move out of that comfort zone of no, don't spend anything, save it all. And in this case, to spend that money responsibly, but to spend that money and to use the gift, the resources that God has given us in sharing gifts with our spouse. So this week, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, make sure that we think about a gift that we can get for our spouse that would make a difference to them. It would make a difference to them. Obviously, the amount is not the point. It's the thought that counts. Okay, acts of service. I remember hearing years and years ago from my good friend Rabbi Goldberger a Torah thought, which is really beautiful. I heard this 25, 30 years ago. Beautiful idea. The Medrash points out that the Torah starts, the five books of Moses, starts with chesed and ends with chesed. It starts with chesed when God gave Adam and Eve clothes. He clothed them, the whole story of the Garden of Eden, they ate from the tree, so he gave them clothing in the Garden of Eden. And it ends with chesed, if you look at the very, very end of the Torah, with Hashem, God himself buries Moses. Buries Moses, no one was involved with the burial, God himself buries Moses. Fine. So the question, of course, is, that's not really true. The world started with chesed way before Adam and Eve needed clothes. The world itself, the creation itself, was a kindness from God. He put all these things in here for us to enjoy. There's a lot of things that the Torah did, that God did, so to speak, for the world before Adam and Eve needed clothes. But what does it mean? Why isn't what Medrash pointing out that the first chesed is giving them clothing that's not actually true? To which the commentaries explain, this was the first true chesed in the sense that God was upset, if we could say such a thing. He was not happy with them. This was the first time someone did something that he didn't approve of. The whole point was, don't eat from that tree. They ate from that tree. And now he's coming in and clothing them and taking care of them and moving them to the next stage of their life. He came to take care of them. And that's a very important message. And that is, we need to do for other people despite the fact we're not in the mood. And specifically when we're not in the mood. Because again, that shows real love. I don't appreciate what you did. I don't like what's going on right this second. But I'm going to give to you anyway. Because we're in this relationship. Love is not dependent on my mood today and how I feel about you right this second. It's something that I do because I care about you. And that's the message of God in this case, and the message of the Medrash. It starts with chesed. That's the first true, absolute chesed that God did, was giving to Adam and Eve when they really didn't deserve it. The story is told. The story is told of a gentleman, husband, sitting and reading his newspaper, minding his own business. His wife walks in and puts down a piece of cake and says, "Happy anniversary." He stops reading, looks up in absolute terror that he forgot their anniversary. And it's quiet for a few seconds, and he says, "Wait a second, our anniversary is 4 months. What do you mean, happy anniversary?" So she says with a smile, "Yeah, but it's been a year since I asked you to fix the cabinet." So he eats the cake and fixes the cabinet. So I remember saying this years ago to a ladies group, and they said, "He ate the cake? How could he eat the cake?" So ladies, you have to, you know, a guy in his cake, you know, you can't get between the man and his food. But the point is, this highly emotionally intelligent woman was trying to get the message across to her husband that there's an act of service here that needs to be done. I want you to do it. She wasn't going to nag. She wasn't going to leave threatening messages on his voicemail. But she wanted it done. And that very often is, let's face it, we're all not always necessarily as emotionally intelligent as that lady in the story. And we do nag, and we do fret, and we do complain, and did you remember to pick this up, and da-da-da. So, you know, a take-home for this week would be to think about what our spouse, what our friends have been asking us to do as an act of service over the last few weeks, and do it. Stop procrastinating, stop putting it off, stop, you know, it's not so important, I've got other things to do, just do it. And again, specifically because it may not be so convenient. It's not on my way to work. It's off, you know. If that act of service is not necessarily easy to do, and I do it anyway, that shows a tremendous amount of love and caring for that person. Okay. Last but not least, certainly, is physical touch. Now, Chapman in the book, I think very wisely and accurately points out that we need to differentiate here between casual physical touch and intimate physical touch. So that someone's love language could be physical touch or not the dominant language, that has nothing to do at all, really, with the intimate part of the relationship. Now, suffice it to say that the whole idea of intimacy and sexuality and connecting in that way has been, as an understatement to say, that our society has butchered the whole concept. And the way it presents the concept to us again and again and again in many different ways is very, very unhealthy. I don't think we have to prove that. In any length, the Torah speaks at great length. And I give a teen group, for example, Shabbos morning for the last many years. We speak regularly about these issues because Judaism has a tremendous amount to say about this whole arena. But at the same time, because it's so special, because it's so important, we don't talk about it flippantly in an open way. And it's very sensitive and very important. Topic. So to go back for a moment to non-physical touch, it should be clear to us that different people relate to physical touch different ways. You see, two of my kids, for example, one from the time she was born was very interested in being held and being tickled and being hugged. It was something that she constantly was interested in from us. And then her sister, not that way at all. You know, there's certain boundaries around, you know, she didn't want to be held as much. She wanted to be alone, you know, on her own, free and free spirit and run around and et cetera. So you see from kids from very, very, very early on that physical resonates more with one than it does with the other. And we're all like that. We're all like that. We don't necessarily talk about it so much, but we should all appreciate that that's true. So that if someone in our life, someone that we love, physical touch is an important language to them. It's one of their top languages. We need to appreciate that, and we need to speak that language to them in the way that they appreciate it. Again, even if it's not necessarily my language, but that may speak to them tremendously, and that fills their love tank in a way that nothing else will. Okay, so there is another program that I've been teaching high school thinker for many years, and one way or other, these topics come up. And make sure they come up. And I cannot say enough times that the single, I argue again and again, the single most important message that young people need to hear is that intimate relationships do not have to be crass or depraved of the way they are portrayed by Hollywood. That they are holy and amazingly important when informed by our tradition, by our Torah. And you know, when you really discuss that with them, it's just amazing the light, you know, the light bulb that goes on, because I think we all have that sense deep inside of us that sexuality doesn't need to be the way it's portrayed by movies, but at the same time, we don't know exactly what. So that's a discussion for another time. I hate to bring it up and not really, but certainly not the setting for that. So we have another program called Sexuality and Marshmallows, the Jewish Approach to Intimacy. You'll have to come to find out how the marshmallows got in there. But, of course, they're back on the market now. There's two books, I think, really tremendous. The presentation that I gave on that is based on this book called Marital Intimacy by a fellow named Kerry Friedman. He works for the OU, the Orthodox Union, in New York. It's a tremendous book, really an amazing, amazing, amazing book. And then there's a thought I want to share with you this morning based on this book called A Hedge of Roses, written by Dr. Norman Lamb in the 50s. Really also just a tremendous, tremendous book. You can take a look at these in the way that you like. They're both available. I can't say enough times how important those books and those ideas are. So one of the points that Dr. Lamb points out, Rabbi Lamb points out, if you look historically, it's really a fascinating observation. See, you look at the Greeks and then the Romans, you see a hedonistic lifestyle. You see the whole focus was on hedonism, was on body, was the new statues. The whole idea of Hanukkah really is the Jews and disagreeing and disavowing themselves, distancing themselves from that whole concept of hedonism. That was the Greek and the Roman legacy to the world. Comes along the church. The Catholic Church was a knee-jerk reaction, to a certain extent, he argues, to that hedonism, and says, this is not working. This is terrible. The hedonism, of course, leads to cruelty, leads to murder, leads to all the horrific stories that all the bad stuff that the Romans are famous for. And the Christian Church came along and said, hedonism is not, it's not body. Body is bad. Body is wrong. Body, focus on the sensual is inappropriate. What really is appropriate is to focus strictly on the soul, on the spiritual side. And celibacy is lauded. It's really the ideal. Person can't handle that. You get married, have a family, but really celibacy and staying totally away from the whole arena of intimacy is really the way to go. He points out that Western man has taken both, not synthesized in any way, but taken both the Greek-Roman idea that the physical is to be applauded, to be put up on a pedestal, and also the strictly physical and strictly spiritual, where the physical side is looked down on, and put them together in kind of an oil-water mixture. Never really synthesized, but they're kind of both there. Judaism teaches that they're both incorrect. They're both missing the mark. Judaism teaches that we are part angel and part animal, and God puts us together to create a human being. We're a unique creation called a human being. So that everything physical in the world is good, as long as it's done together with the spiritual component. The two sides are synthesized. The two sides are synthesized. One is not bad or good. The two sides need to work together. So that every single physical pleasure in the world is a good thing. Thinking about Jews and food. Is a good thing. Maybe not too much of it. But it's a good thing as long as it's done in a spiritual framework. And that is a basic, I mean, that's Judaism in a nutshell, really. Judaism pushes pleasure and enjoyment and really enjoying the world and living life to its fullest without guilt, without bemoaning the fact that I'm a physical being, because it's a synthesis of the physical and the spiritual. So that obviously speaks volumes. Again, we're not going to get into the gory details right now, but speaks volumes to this whole arena of physical touch and intimacy. Okay, let me stop, take my breath, and open the floor to some questions before we close up. Okay. Not that good or bad. I mean, no tomatoes have been thrown. That's a good one.
You recommend asking yourself, which would be fine.
Excellent. Thank you for asking.
Or do you just need to figure it out?
That's an excellent question. So first, again, you'll all be getting a book before you leave. At the back of the book is a questionnaire. There's a question, you know, A or B, 30 different questions, one for husbands, one for wives. And that questionnaire helps you figure out what your love language is. So I certainly recommend thinking about it first, you know, giving it some thought, and then taking the quiz, see if if your thoughts are not necessarily in sync with the quiz, see if the quiz resonates, if it's valid to you, and then discuss it. And then discuss, you know, that's certainly the guide to figuring yourself out. I've had people come and say that love language changes over time, which is certainly a possibility. Meaning, if someone's receiving what they need, they may not recognize it as a real need, because that part of them is filled. So it could certainly change over time. But, certainly having a conversation about this, but I think the beauty of this model is it structures the conversation. You know, there's these five, what do you think? You know, you come up with something very specific that that we can follow. Yes, sir?
When you go through that exercise and look at the five different levels of expression, examine the differences. Do you think differences are different more by individual personality, or there's innate differences between men and women?
Excellent question. The answer is yes. Chapman does not speak at all to gender differences. Maybe very wisely, he just totally avoids the issue. He did not speak. At the same time, let's face it, there is a multi-billion-dollar industry of giving gifts to women, which is not balanced by power tools at Home Depot. It's not the same thing. You know, a tie is a tie, but it's not flowers and chocolate. So one assumes, I mean, I've never done the study, but one assumes that gifts, for example, is much something that resonates more often with women than it does with the guys. Quality time. We could guess around this forever. But, and he is not, some have criticized him for this, but he is not super strong, at least in the books, on research. And it's not psychobabble, and, you know, if you read John Gottman's stuff, for example, he's very research-based, everything's empirically proven, which has, I think, has its strength. Yeah, but I've chosen to speak for the five alone women, which is not empirical stuff. At the end of the day, I think it's fascinating, but at the end of the day, who cares? Meaning, you know, it's just really you and your spouse, you and your friends. But there probably are, yeah. Other questions? Yes, sir.
Well, having not read the book yet, why, in your opening remarks, why a Jewish version? I mean, if the other so explicitly Christian?
Excellent question.
Why do we need a Jewish version of that?
Yeah, so Dr. Chapman is actually a minister. And Raleigh Durham, and he does. He's not super duper Christian. He told me he tried not to make it, you know, overpowering, but at the same time, there's definitely Christian content in the book. So, in years ago, when we started looking into this, we kept like going away from it because how can we do Jewish presentations with New Testament quotations and all that kind of stuff? And we kept coming back to it because it's good. I mean, it's really an easy read. It's a short book. Great stories. Like I said, there's very little psychobabble. I mean, it's just really, really good stuff. So then the question was, can we present this in the Jewish audience? And the answer I got time and time again from my mentors was, no, you just cannot use the book the way it is. So we went through a bunch of different steps. But the bottom line is we were encouraged to ask the author permission to send to the book. I didn't use that word on the phone, but that's exactly, he understood exactly what I meant. So... And I could tell from the book he was going to say yes. Like, you just tell. But there was, I guess I got on the phone with him. It's kind of funny, you call a church and you say it's Rabbi from Atlanta. They tend to call you right back. So he did, you know, his secretary called me. Can you call him, you know, Monday morning, whatever it is? I said, great. I call him right back. And we schmoozed for about 25 minutes. Really sweet guy. And he said, like, I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to say I want to censor your book. And I'm like, I don't want to leave certain things. So I didn't, you know, I forget exactly how I said those words, but he said, no problem, I think it's a great idea. We really want to get this out. You know, it's like Coke. They want to get it out to everywhere, anywhere. You know. But the publisher who has the final say is not going to go for it, which I knew already. It's Moody Publishers in Chicago. It's not Random House. It's a evangelical Christian publishing house. Mm. And there's no way in the world. He said they're probably not going to go for it, but I will call and I'll see what they say. Well, I get a call a week later from the publisher's secretary saying, it's an interesting request, We want to talk to you about it. So I wasn't quite sure. You guys are not getting a call back, but I wasn't quite sure. So I got on the phone with a fellow, and he was very sweet. I've had an ongoing contact with him, relationship with him, and he was all for it. He just said, "I'll send you the Word docs, and you'll send, you know, you'll change them the way you want to, and we'll prove it." And I got a license agreement, and he said, "You can change the cover." I said, "Great." He said, "We want a certain percent of gross." I said, "Great." Like, I wasn't planning on, you know, making a penny off of this. But the organization does make a few dollars, so that's, you know, that's how it unfolded. So the, you know, the bottom line is, we couldn't. What we thought was a tremendous problem so often in life ended up being a tremendous asset. Really, yeah. Excellent question. The question, yes, let me repeat the question. How do you maintain it, right? Conquering Iraq is the easy part. It's keeping Iraq, that's the hard part. That's what you think. So that's very true. We should all appreciate that in life. Whenever we start something new, the question, the trick is how to keep it going. Okay, so I'm sure you're all familiar with the fact that the self-help industry is huge in this country. You go into a bookstore or Amazon, and there's a lot obviously on websites, but there's hundreds and thousands of self-help books. So the research on this shows that 80-some-odd% of the folks who buy a self-help book, which means they're self-selecting themselves to say, "I want to change, I want to grow, I want to whatever," 80-some-odd% do nothing. They read the book, they put it back on the shelf, and it gathers dust. So the secret, of course, is people, as in so much the rest of our lives. The real secret to growth, short-term and certainly long-term, is people, which means getting together in a group like this and having these conversations and having some type of ongoing engagement with others who are working on this together. That's really the secret to everything, because just read the book, it's nice, it's a good first step, you'll, you know, you'll connect over it, and you'll go out to dinner, and you'll smooth it over, but to keep it going really means some type of study, some type of focus. And that is a great segue for me to, you know, to talk a little bit about the organization. Our goal really is to design and present this type of stuff to the Jewish world. It's a major movement in the Christian world called the Marriage Education Movement. Well-funded, there's an annual conference in the summer, thousands of people show up, and most of the work is done in churches, which is why I suspect almost no one here has ever been, because we don't generally, it's just not a comfortable environment for us. So our goal is to design this so that it is comfortable for Jews of all backgrounds. Religious, you know, religiosity is not the issue here at all. It's the Jewish approach and attitude and feeling that we all have in the study, so that my goal is to get folks, mental health professionals, rabbis, lay leaders, and whoever is interested in this, to do the work, you know, boots on the ground type of stuff, everywhere, across the country, across the world. That's ultimately our goal. It's going to take a couple of days to get there. But that's ultimately our goal, is to get the, you know, the rabbi stars of the world, to get different people, again, different, coming from a psychology perspective, from rabbinic, whatever it is, but to do this type of work. Because in answering your question, the only way that this is really going to make an impact is if we do this, and it doesn't mean every week, but it does mean, you know, several programs a year, and this is what I do, and I, you know, one of the suggestions we make in the book and the forward is to pick up the book every fall. Traditionally, throughout Jewish history, fall time is a time in Shul, Shabbos morning, we read about the families, the patriarchs and the matriarchs and their interactions. So it's always been a trigger for rabbis to speak about these issues. So we suggest that's a great time, after the holidays are over, things have settled down a little bit, back to work, to pick up the book every year and read it. And to read your highlights, to read the pages that resonate specifically with you, there's obviously a gazillion, you know, there's a million ways to peel this onion. There's lots and lots of different books out there, but certainly keeping it simple and ongoing is the trick to success. Yes, sir.
So when you use the word impetus, kind of spark another thought. So did you read Chapman's book before and inspire you to make the Jewish version of it? Or?
Yeah.
Okay. So the impetus is there, as a rabbi and looking at our people, and I mean, are we having an issue with the quality of Jewish marriages, or
yeah,
is there a predilection for divorce rates, or of course we all know about intermarriage, but
it's a good question. I don't know if there's really good firm statistics specifically in the Jewish world, but suffice it to say, we all know that the American divorce rate, and just, you know, discord and divorce, is huge. I mean, it's just skyrocketing. Many, many reasons. If you could probably sit down and come over 10 without thinking about it much. Many, many reasons. And the answer is not going to be get rid of everyone's technology and get rid of the bad role modeling that we're all getting from media. You know, all that stuff is you know, our society is what it is, and we can try and filter it to a certain extent. But the real answer is what we as Jews have always done, and that is to learn. To learn the messages of the Torah, psychology, the stories that we talk about, and to fortify ourselves to be stronger. But is there a problem? There's no question there's a problem. It's, you know, again, I don't know what the firm statistics are, but there's definitely a major problem. And I think we all agree that marriage is the brick of everything else. The brick of everything else. I mean, the Jewish world, if you look at Jewish history, has dealt with a lot of problems. A lot of problems. And we always rise to the occasion somehow and address those anti-Semitism or it's a long list of different challenges. So I would argue that you know, at this point in history, this is the challenge. The challenge is to rise up and figure out how to make sure our relationships and our kids' relationships and our grandkids' relationships are strong and firm and unbreakable, despite, you know, again, all the bad messages we're getting from the media and all the, you know, this celebrity is, you know, married for 3 months and divorced and that, you know, all the craziness that's going on in our very open, free society shouldn't influence us because we're reacting in a good and healthy way.
That's cool.
Okay, other questions before we close up? Okay, so let me just close with a couple comments. And that is, again, just picking up where we left off before about the need and the reaction to it. I mean, imagine, think back to your youth and to your education. Imagine a program in elementary school already, not focusing on marriage per se, but focusing on concepts like the five love languages and many, many other concepts that are specifically geared towards interpersonal relationships. Unfortunately, typically, if you think back to your educational experience, probably wasn't really there. Maybe in kindergarten, that's the famous book about kindergarten. But the vast majority of our training is about math and reading, right? Right? It's really not focused at all on interpersonal relationships. Imagine a program in day schools and in camps and youth groups that really does make this a serious focus. And particularly in high school, when kids are getting a little older and they're in their first relationships, that the opportunities be there, age-appropriate opportunities be there for our young people to hear these types of messages. And then in college, 18, 20, 22, 24-year-olds who are first in their serious relationships and again have very, very little guidance from almost anyone. It's almost taboo these days for parents to talk to their kids about it. It's certainly not discussed in a healthy way in media or other interactions. So most of the information our young people are getting is from MTV, is from HBO, is from all these different places. So imagine a program that would really truly address that in an open, honest way where kids can ask their questions and be addressed as adults, which they really need to be. And then for us, for adults, either in a relationship or going to be in a relationship, again, to have this material presented in a way, the opportunity to ask questions, again, some gender specific, some mixed gender, but to really be able to learn this stuff, it's the most important area of our life. It gets sometimes the least amount of focus, but our relationships are the most important part of our lives and allow us to do everything else that we want to do in the world, as we saw from Raphael. So my charge, my request to each and every one of you is not only to read the book, which I hope you certainly do. Take home a copy, read, share, enjoy the book. Again, I think it's a great read. But two other things. One is to tell people that you came. To tell people that you came to a class and you discussed these issues and it's important to you. Because then you're a role model to them to do the same kind of thing. And whether it's us or somebody else is obviously not the point. But that they should understand that this is something that you think is important. Especially your kids, your grandkids, and people that look up to you for guidance. Share that. You're not embarrassed to say you're married X number of years and it's an ongoing growth process. That's number one. And number two, ladies and gentlemen, my goal, as I said before, is to try very hard to make this a national or international movement. And we know illusions that this obviously there'll be different flavors and different approaches and different, but to put this more and more on the map. And what I've seen from my research is that there are lots of people doing this type of work, but it's very small scale, a little bit here, a little bit there. Not well funded, it's not a serious curriculum. There have been people talking about it in different ways in their own synagogues or JCCs or I spoke to the insurance guy in LA that does lunch and learns with guys, you know, like every day of his lunch. That's what he does. Beautiful, beautiful thing. Well, what I would ask is that you take this idea of helping spread, taking the initiative, and helping spread this to other people by making connections, by doing what Alan did, which is hearing about this and bringing it to HOD, to allow us to spread this to other places, other communities. And you know, I think this is something that is one of the few topics that all Jews can rally around. Right? Because unfortunately, plenty of things that keep us apart philosophically, theologically, we're not going there. But relationships, strong families, is one of those few things that is just basic. It's basic to every single Jewish person. It certainly should be. So to consider doing what Alan did, to call your great aunt you haven't spoken to in 1,000 years in Kalamazoo and say, you know, is there an opportunity for this type of presentation to be brought there? No illusions that anyone's going to get rich off of this. But we do have a dream that this type of program really takes root and really makes a significant difference so that following generations will have less struggle with this, less issues with this than we're seeing currently. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.